The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Now listen, coming up right now, there is another superstar VIP guest that we have on the line from a place called Mountain States Legal Foundation. Cody, you're on the phone right now. Listen, I was going to take a stab at your last name, but I'm going to screw it up. Is it Smith? No, I'm kidding.
It's pretty close.
How do you pronounce it?
Wisniewski.
You know what? I could have guessed that. Wisniewski. Cody, you are from Mountain States Legal Foundation, and I think what's so timely and important about you being on here, and thank you for making time early on your Saturday morning, is that you handle a lot of cases, not just in Colorado, but in the region, related to Second Amendment rights. And there was a case this week that came out of a place called Gunnison, Colorado, one of the most beautiful places on the planet Earth, that addressed the red flag law that Colorado adopted last year. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, and first and foremost, thank you so much for having me on this morning.
Oh, sure.
I really appreciate it. So a case came out, it dealt with the constitutionality of the recent extreme risk protection order, a red flag law in Colorado. And there, the respondent who had got the order sought against them, their attorney challenged the constitutionality of the act on its face. And I think there's an important element here in that they didn't challenge the act as applied to the person, meaning that they pretty much realized that it was probably an appropriate exercise of it as applied, but they were concerned about the overall constitutionality of it.
Now, one of the things that I looked at when I read this opinion is that it's not a poorly written opinion. I mean, they go through and they tackle some important arguments that I think I have made myself on the radio and I've heard other people make about things like substantial risk is undefined, so therefore it's void for vagueness, and it's a violation under Heller, under the personal right of Second Amendment. Tell us how they reasoned through that.
Yeah, and, you know, I actually think that it is a very well-written opinion, but that reasoning through Heller is where the opinion becomes a little bit problematic. Basically, the court is saying that it applies this two-step test that's common in the Tenth Circuit, not necessarily under Heller, but I can leave that. But when it does that, it says that an extreme risk protection order doesn't implicate the Second Amendment because it doesn't restrict a law-abiding, responsible citizen from possessing arms. Now, I don't really know how the court got to that conclusion, except for the idea that they're saying that this is not a law-abiding, responsible citizen, but that then assumes some form of adjudication under the act.
And what they've said in there, and you saw this part, was they said, well, look, it requires a court to find by clear and convincing evidence that this person is a substantial risk to themselves or others by having possession of a firearm. So they tried to define you, just like you said, into a category where you're not a responsible law-abiding citizen. What's the problem with that?
The problem is what they're doing is they're making these definitions in that ex parte basis. So that initial hearing, you don't have any notice of, you don't have any opportunity to defend yourself, you don't have counsel. So that's problematic. And the court tries to analogize this to some of those categories that Heller set forth that the court considered to be presumptively lawful. And one of those were felon in possession laws. So it doesn't specify that they're analogizing it to the felon in possession portion, but that seems the most directly relevant. The problem is, if you are a felon, then you've at least had the opportunity for some form of due process while also having a much higher standard than clear and convincing. You have beyond a reasonable doubt, unless obviously you pled and whatnot, but you at least had the opportunity for that.
How does the court address, and are you satisfied with the way it addresses that lower due process standard at the front end for that temporary order, the two-week one that says, hey, if by a preponderance of the evidence, just based on a pleading, by the way, just based on an affidavit, the court could find that you're no longer apparently a responsible law-abiding citizen, at least for those 2 weeks. How do they rationalize that?
Yeah, and the way that they go through and rationalize that is they basically say that somebody who is seeking this order has some skin in the game. They have to, you know, swear an affidavit. There is can be a penalty for seeking a false order in some context. So basically, they try and heighten the stakes for the person seeking it. And I don't really think that that's You know, it's going to be really difficult for somebody to try and then get some form of liability against someone who sought an order for them. So they kind of skirt around that initial issue, and they really don't tangle with the problem of an ex parte hearing when you're talking about, you know, constitutionally protected rights. And that's where it gets really wishy-washy in the opinion.
Now, listen, when they one thing that I saw, and you're the expert here, not me, one thing I saw that I found troubling was how interchangeably the court seemed to use the terms substantially likely, in the near future and imminent, as if those terms were synonyms. And the court relies heavily on imminence as if to bootstrap in some other cases and reasoning that say, look, this is a public safety issue because of this imminent. The statute never uses the term imminent. It could have. It uses the term in the near future. Like, what in the heck does that mean?
Yeah, and that's where – so the party in this case did seek a void for vagueness challenge, saying that it, you know, there's some unclear language in there. While the court recognizes that that's supposed to be a heightened test because you're talking about explicitly it assumes a constitutionally protected right. It doesn't really give it that treatment. It doesn't give it that higher level of treatment. That being said, in these contexts, something like that in this void for vagueness challenge on, you know, that type of language is going to be really difficult, especially when you're talking about, you know, a Second Amendment case. They're going to give some deference to the enforcing body. They know that a judge, that in this case, this judge, is the one that's reviewing it. So those challenges, unless there was some form of language in there that truly was uninterpretable, then it's pretty unlikely that they're going to be able to push that void for vagueness question.
So, and we're talking with Cody Wisniewski from Mountain States Legal Foundation, a Second Amendment expert and a guy who fights cases and laws and stuff like this all over. For 710 listeners, and I got to tell you, man, 710 listeners are big time Second Amendment folks. All gun owners, I presume, at some level, or someone in their household is, just like me, probably just like you. What's the silver lining, if any, here? I mean, having read this opinion, and I have to say, I during the process of this law, which I thought was way overbroad, than it would not nearly enough due process protections as is needed, I was still telling folks, look, we don't have a good history of jurisprudence that stands up for a Second Amendment. I mean, outside of Heller, you got to really scramble to find a good Second Amendment case in the last, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Do you have any optimism given this opinion and our law of this thing being undone through the state courts versus the federal?
You know, it's tough. This opinion doesn't necessarily give me, you know, some clear optimism. I think, like I said, there's some problems in the court's reasoning. I don't know if they're intending on moving forward and challenging that at all. But obviously this opinion's limited. It's one district court opinion coming out of Gunnison. It's not the end of the road for the issue area and whatnot. And the key here is you also have to ensure that it's a case that brings forth the challenges, frames the issues appropriately, and then is able to tangle with those constitutional issues. But as I mentioned earlier, the underlying, there's no as-applied challenge here. They weren't worried about the person who got the order sought against them in this case. And, you know, it's my understanding that there was some independent means and that there was a charge elsewhere where he could also have lost his firearm rights, according to the state. So that complicates things, and it's going to be really difficult for any judge, even if they think that the act may be unconstitutional, to overrule it in a context where there's a person there that probably fits under at least the definition of the act. So
what I hear you saying, though, is that, look, these aren't great facts for us anyway. And if you read the first part of the opinion, I know you did, the issues presented, you're right. I mean, the other side gave up a whole bunch of potential issues to try to narrow the focus to just these constitutional ones. But what I hear you saying, and this makes sense, man, this is an appellate smart thing to say, and that is this is probably not the one we want to push forward, right? We want to find that other one that puts the court in a position to make some decisions where the facts are a little bit more favorable. Is that fair?
Yeah. And I mean, you actually mentioned Heller. That's a great example of it. I mean, Dick Heller was a security guard at the Thurgood Marshall Courthouse, where he had a firearm to protect the court, but then lived a few blocks down the road and couldn't have a firearm to protect himself in his home. That kind of, when you bring that fact pattern before a court, courts are much more likely to be, you know, interested in what you have to say. If you walk in on an extreme risk protection and it's somebody that, you know, might otherwise have been deprived of their rights, then it's a lot tougher to have the court listen.
Now, in the last 30 seconds that I have with you, when you look at our ERPO, our red flag law, however you want to call it, where do you think it's the most vulnerable to a constitutional challenge?
The court has expressed a lot of concern. The Supreme Court has expressed a lot of concern with, there's an 80s case dealing with this, of allowing for this kind of ex parte when you're talking about fundamental rights. And in McDonald in 2010, the Supreme Court authoritatively said the Second Amendment protects a fundamental right. So I think that level of scrutiny is where the ultimate question is going to be on the right case.
Well, Cody, this is fantastic. Look, I'd love to have you back on again, not to just talk about what is going on in Colorado, but the other things and the other fires you're putting out or starting around the country. Hopefully you'd be willing to come back on.
Absolutely. More than happy to.
Cody Wisniewski, Mountain States Legal Foundation, Second Amendment expert. Thank you so much for giving us some of your Saturday morning. We're going to cut away for a quick break. When we come back, I think the first of Lauren Boebert's interviews on 710 KNUS just for a Saturday. I mean, at some point, all AM radio is going to become Lauren Boebert radio. But we're going to have her on after the break to talk about what's going on out in Garfield County, in Rifle, with her restaurant and these public health orders. My name's George Brockler. This is The George Show. You're listening to 710 KNUS.